In view of the time available, ladies and gentlemen, what we will do is I will ask perhaps for a few questions. So if you have a question, then let us know, and let us know now, and we'll take a few questions at once, and then Sydney can you know, fill us in on what you'd like to know, rather than going backwards and forwards. So are there any immediate questions?
I think it's a very good question. We have no other material at all. What we saw tonight was what was left that could be saved. But there were, of course, scenes that were so badly deteriorated chemically that they just had to go. I always think when I see the very last part of that film, there surely must have been a shot from the girl's point of view of the cart with the horse and the gentleman friend disappearing into the sunset or whatever. And of course, that shot is not there. And I suppose it was so badly deteriorated, they just couldn't save it. There is nothing else. We are very, as a family, we are very pleased to have what you have just seen available. And if you like to do it with the arithmetic that my family thinks of, if we start with my grandmother, who was the one who said, why are we in the one corner of this lovely country? Why shouldn't we be in the middle? If we count her, we're into our fifth continuous contribution, fifth generation of my family into the British film production sector. I think we're so fortunate now that we've got that beautiful sound. I hope you enjoyed just the music itself, because I think it's beautifully done. And it belongs to us, and it will always be attached to that film. So I like to think when the 10th generation is looking at this 200-year-old film, or whatever it works out as, they'll see the music track that was produced so elegantly by John Sweeney, the composer. He composed it, and I think I told you, and he recorded it, and it was beautifully edited. And I suppose I have to say the film is not absolutely complete, but my goodness, when my youngest son, Mark, and I were invited to the annual Italian Archive Film Festival in Portonoy, Italy, just about 25 miles north of Milan, and they showed two G.B. Samuelson films. That one, in its pre-reconstructed version, and then another of my father's films, which was called The Unwanted. That is in a pretty bad state, and I think that unless some kind person says, well, I'll give you a few thousand pounds, which is what it cost for us to turn the original remnants of a film found in an attic in Belgium into what you just saw. It's not cheap. It takes a long time and a great deal of skill. But we're very happy that we've got one of my father's silent films with a soundtrack. What I would love to know is what the original soundtrack was like. You probably know that when the print of a silent film arrived in those times, also the sheet music arrived, which was matched to the visuals that you were going to see, and the musical accompaniment could be anything from one pianist, which is what we've all heard tonight, or to a full orchestra. None of that printed sheet music has survived. I wish it had, because I'd love to hear what it, the composer in those days, what it sounded like. And I would like to have also been sitting in a cinema to hear maybe a 20-piece orchestra playing the musical accompaniment. But it is almost unique, I think, that there is an absolutely silent film originating as a silent film, which now has a permanent musical accompaniment attached to it. So it can be enjoyed, not quite the same as having a live orchestra, but pretty jolly near it, and certainly better than just sitting in silence and watching the action as it unfolds. So we're very happy that the BFI, with their skill, and the Samuelsons, with their interest and their history in the British film industry, together we've able to produce what you've just seen, and it's available for anybody to borrow it. Any society like this, it can be seen and heard, and we're really proud of having achieved that, because there's not much of that around.
There was also a question about the tinting, whether the choice of tints in the film is original, whether it was a decision made by the reconstructors.
I think it must have been. What do we think? I'm just trying to remember. I suppose it was 100% sepia toned in its original version. But then it wasn't all sepia today, but that probably during the process at BFI in Berkhamsted, when they'd eventually reconstructed whatever they can. And there are different things. If you've got, let's say you've got 8 frames which have got so much chemical deterioration, they've got to be cut out. There's no way, there's not enough to build from to recreate those 8 frames. So you've got to cut them out. Now, 8 frames is actually, in those days, only half of a second. But a lot of action can happen. If someone's waving their arm for half a second, on the first of those 8 frames, it may have been here. Then 8 frames have had to be cut out, and the arm may be here when you cut back in it, so that there's a huge jump in the visual if you've got to replace 8 frames. And there are various decisions have to be taken as to how to deal with those missing 8 frames. And some of the answers, I was asked for my opinion, and I said a 2-second dissolve where one frame is not cut with the joint, 2 pieces of film are not joined up but with 8 frames missing. But if you do a 1-second dissolve, it's amazing how less painful it is, because you somehow or other don't see the jump like that from the 8 frames that are missing. They've got all sorts of tricks up their sleeves at Berkhamsted, I can tell you. And when my son and I first saw the scene not restored, little tiny things, I think, were done in Belgium, and little tiny things were done in Amsterdam, but it was nothing like we've seen tonight, and we have to thank the BFI for providing the experience and the skill for this film being in a kind of a watchable condition. When we saw it in Italy, it was really painful to see some of it because the deterioration, the emulsion sliding down the frame and the missing frames, we had to bear that. But since it's been at the BFI, I think that kind of what's missing is so much less noticeable, and I feel we're very fortunate to have this version of one of my father's films.
Yes, I remember that, that there's a dissolve in the scene in the living room in the yes. In the cottage, and yes, you just see it, and then they're back, and it certainly is a lot less intrusive than a large jump like that would be, as you say. I'll go back to the audience now and ask if we have any further questions.
Oh, yes. That's. I'm glad you asked that, because we had, and it was me personally, arguing with the BFI, because the few subtitles that were left, the BFI, when I said, and this included the opening titles and the end titles that you saw, they were unhappy about those new titles, which I had designed so that they looked like old titles in the style of the script. But they said, we have a rule at the BFI that we only restore what was found in the original print that was delivered to us. We don't create anything to go with the film that was not there when it was found prior to restoration. Eventually, we won the argument. I'm sure the BFI would have said, well, okay, we'll put in the extra titles, which, of course, they explain quite a lot about the making of the film and where it was made. And can you imagine reproducing those battle scenes, dragging those guns and firing those guns? That would be expensive stuff to reproduce. But there must have been some kind of a deal for the charity, for the Royal Artillery, who provided all those troops. And it was pretty well put together. Of course, all the opening stuff of the Armistice Day parade, that was all actual newsreel stuff of the day. I think it's greatly helped by the atmosphere created by the music. So you can't have everything. There was only sort of three quarters of a film available to us, but we've been able to add a little bit of explanation about who was responsible for the film, etc. And we're quite happy to have what we've got. And I'm now lucky enough to have great-grandchildren, and I hope I'm still around when they're old enough. The oldest one is only 5 at the moment. But I hope I'll be able to introduce him to a film made by his great-great-grandfather 100-and-something years ago. I'm sort of looking forward to that, ladies and gentlemen.
Fantastic. Do we have a further question from the audience? Is it possible that a DVD could be available for the public?
Yes, you can buy it from the BFI. That's part of our deal with them. We can make our DVD copies available for worthy organisations such as this one. But if you want to have your own DVD, then it does have the music track on it. The BFI were not thrilled to bits about this new music track as part of this old movie, but nevertheless it is available from the BFI shop, and I've no idea how much it is, but I don't think it'll be too expensive. Whether they've got copies of on the shelf, I don't know. The first showing of it was in BFI Theatre 1 on that beautiful giant screen, and with John Sweeney playing live piano, sitting in the dark with no music in front of him and making it up as he went along. What a brilliant talent that is.
Absolutely. There was a gentleman there with a question. Yes, you, sir.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing it clearly enough. Can you repeat it to me?
Yes. So what inspired the... I think you said earlier that the author of the short story became the director of the film.
Yes, he did. Walter Summers.
Walter Summers. What was Mr. Summers' director... what his inspiration for choosing that theme? Do we know if he was in a similar situation himself, or was he just a writer of fiction?
He was a staff writer in my father's studio, and he would write what he was told to write. I don't mean he would write, be told the actual words, but he would be given his assignment, and my father gave him this short story from the Strand magazine and said, I think that would make a feature film. Go and write it. And then, as I said, he was also offered his first chance of directing, and then that led to a whole career of, this is a good guy to have if you've got First World War scenes to reproduce.
And the Strand story itself was a fiction story rather than a sort of true life story?
Well, I suppose it all had to be based on true events, didn't it? I mean, there was nothing there that didn't actually happen during the...
Yes, of course.
...what went on across France and Belgium during the First World War.
Oh, indeed. The gentleman's question was saying you had in your family, someone did something similar of buying... Yes, of buying a horse that they... After the war, they bought a horse that they had served with during the war, so that was a possible inspiration, that kind of thing happening.
That's really interesting. And I think what would have happened was this ex-soldier, an officer, right, well, he would have probably had a privilege that when he was about to be demobbed, he could say, I'd like to buy my horse to come with me. That I would think, and I'm just surmising this, that the horse survived, obviously, and became a civilian horse in barracks immediately after the First World War armistice. And this lieutenant, before he was demobilized, he may have still had that horse as his army horse in whatever he was doing immediately after the war. And then he would ask if he could buy that horse when he was about to leave the army. I think those circumstances would be different for an out-of-work corporal who wanted to buy a horse. He wouldn't have the access It would not, I imagine, be the same if a private soldier wanted to buy his horse. I think they would have been separated by that time. I wasn't there, so I don't know. But that's quite interesting that that could happen, that you could be demobbed and you could take your horse with you. I got very upset when I was demobbed because they wouldn't let me keep my greatcoat. I thought that would be a useful thing to have. And you could either keep your boots or your shoes. You couldn't keep both. Slightly different to talking about a horse. But that must have been a pretty wonderful thing. You arrive as a civilian, maybe on a farm somewhere, and you've got your horse with you that you've had for years and years and years. How good must that have been?
Now, Sydney, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid that it is now 9:55, so I think we will have to wrap up, as my understanding is that we're likely to be removed from the building by the security guards quite soon. So I'll conclude by saying, once again, thank you very much, Sir Sydney Samuelson. It's been a pleasure to have you here. It's been a pleasure to have this amazing film here. And I'm sure we're all grateful and like to show our appreciation once again.